Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our anchor sponsor, Gateway Marketing Cafe. If, like me, you're not much of a shopper and you want to give a gift that works for everyone, consider Gateway gift cards. They're great stocking stuffers and can be used at Gateway Market, Django, Centro, Zombie Burger, and any other Des Moines business in the Orchestrate network. And for every $100 you spend on gift cards, you get an additional $20 card free. So if my kids are listening to this program today, yeah, you're getting Gateway gift cards again, like every year. So folks, if you're inclined, pick them up at Gateway Market or any Orchestrate hospitality business and mention you heard about them on the Fallon Forum. Thanks to all of our sponsors, including Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry, with 23 years of experience in the business. Joe's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. Hey, thanks to the Des Moines Iowa Recession for our bumper music. Later in the program, we'll be talking with Brittany Prater about her new film about the Iowa caucuses. We'll be talking about public education. First, though, it's my delight to welcome J.D. Scholten to the program. J.D. is a state representative from Sioux City in northwest Iowa. He ran for Congress a couple times in the toughest district in the state and did very, very well, nearly won once. He's also the founder of a publication with a very blunt title, You're Probably Getting Screwed. He's also a professional baseball pitcher. And before we talk about corporate monopolies, mergers, and Tyson in particular, J.D., as a professional baseball pitcher, I got to ask you, what's your prediction for the MLB season in 2026?
Well, the season itself, I got to go with the Minnesota Twins being a Twins fan, even though they need new ownership and the kind of organization in a little bit of a dismay. But the big thing with Major League Baseball is that after next year is when the CBA is up and they're going to have contract negotiations between the players union and MLB, the commissioner's office and all that. So that's everybody's kind of on thin ice kind of or anxiety of some level, worrying about what's going to happen, whether there's going to be a strike or a lockout or something like that.
Interesting. I had not heard about that. Okay.
Yeah. All right. So that's the winter meetings are going on right now. And so everyone's playing nice right now, but a year from now, it's going to be all eyes on there.
Okay. Interesting. I personally wish baseball would be more affordable to the average person. I can't believe how ticket prices have gone off the charts, but yep, That's true of all, you know, professional sports, I guess.
Yeah.
Hey, on to more.
We'll be priced out as middle class Americans.
Well, yeah,
a lot of things.
We could talk about that's another way in which we're being screwed, right? Hey, your recent publication on Tyson, I thought was very interesting. Apparently, they're getting ready to shut down one of the biggest beef packing plants in the country. And, you had some good information about why that's not just a local Midwest issue that's going to affect 3,000 people.
Yeah. Yeah. The plant itself employs 3,000 people in a town of 12,000. So that's a wow. Quarter of the population that works there. That's not accounting for all the farmers and ranchers that send their cattle there. And along with this announcement, Tyson announced that they were going to be shifting the Amarillo plant from two shifts to one shift going forward. And so you combine the closing down of Lexington, Nebraska, and the shutting off the second shift down in Amarillo, that's 7% of the market on a daily basis in the entire U.S. Cattle industry.
What's the motivation? How is that going to benefit Tyson? Presuming that Tyson's only interested in making money, how's it going to how's it going to impact them?
So they're, my understanding, they'll just say, and this is a very monopoly thing, saying, oh, it's a money, the numbers don't add up. Well, in Nebraska, if you're a farmer, or a rancher of cattle, and you have contract with the Lexington plant, the next closest plant is also a Tyson plant. And so if they shut that down, the demand's not going down. So a lot of that can shift over to one of these other plants. So that's, they're feeling like they can have more control over ranchers right now on that side.
But how does that benefit them? How does that benefit them to lose 3,000 workers and close access for a lot of farmers and ranchers, only to have them be sent to a different location?
Well, here's how it really benefits them. We are having record amount of imported. I think that's the thing that people aren't drawing enough attention. I'd tell it like this. Think of how we've offshored our manufacturing. This is the same thing when it comes to beef processing. With the amount that we're bringing in from South America, especially Brazil and Argentina, they make more money off of that than they do if raising cattle and processing here and doing everything here. I mean, the labor costs are a lot less down there. And so it all gets back to this manufacturing style of how we eat and industrialization of all this. And so it's to me, this is a canary in the coal mine type of situation where this is just jaw dropping that this happened. This is going to impact all of us. It's going to raise price on beef more. And we're seeing that. And the crazy thing is that there's the Wall Street Journal headline from November 2024. So right when this happened, it said Tyson closes a beef plant and meat companies stocks rise. If that doesn't tell you the exact situation of what's happening in the American economy right now, I don't know what else does.
So the beef being imported from South America, a lot of that is on land that used to be rainforest that was cleared and become pasture land.
The Brazilian, yep.
Yeah, and so That beef is then being shipped live to the U.S. or processed?
No, they'll harvest it down there. But then when they ship it, then they'll repackage it up here and slice it up into different types of things. So they'll send like a half carcass or things like that up here. And then they'll redistribute it. And the fact that they did that work in America after it's been shipped, there's no law protecting country of origin labeling. Right now. And so they can package. So if you go to your local grocery store, if it's not a co-op or something like that, and you have one of these, like you go to Hy-Vee, most of it comes, a lot of their meat comes from Tyson. There's no guarantee, even though it says product of the USA, there's no guarantee that meat is from the United States.
And to be clear, the processing facilities that operate in Brazil are owned by Tyson.
Right.
Okay.
And the ones that aren't, I think there might be ones that aren't as well, but it's they work with Tyson.
Okay. And the bottom line is the workers there are paid much lower wages.
Yeah, exactly. It's like what we saw with NAFTA.
Right.
We are outsourcing our food supply, and that should be a red flag to every American, regardless of where you are at politically.
Now, are Tyson workers in the U.S. Unionized?
Some of them are, some of them not. It's a mixed bag.
How about in Lexington?
Like even in Western Iowa, I know there are some and other meatpacking plants that are not, and some are Tyson, some are not. So it's something that's really hard to organize because there's so many different languages spoken at these, because they bring in immigrant workforce, and with all these different languages, different cultures, it's really hard to unionize them. And Tyson has, along with the other monopolies, the JBSs, the the National Beef, the Cargills, they've really tried to put a wedge between all the workers, so they just continue to get paid lower wages than what they used to.
Now, my understanding is that those four companies, Tyson, JBS, Cargill, and National Beef, control about 80% of the entire beef industry.
Yep.
And when I say beef industry, I mean the processing side of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. And so, if you're a rancher, let's say you grew up farming and ranching and all that stuff, where you used to have a lot of options, you only have a handful anymore. Like I've gone to the Dunlap in Dunlap, Iowa, the Dunlap livestock auction down there.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to see. It's very fascinating. But like that place used to be full when I was a kid. Now it's just that, again, there's just a few representatives because there's really not an option other than the four big players.
So it's that's an auction. The facility in Dunlap,
yep.
It's a sale barn, right?
Yep.
And so why are farmers not opting to go there instead of doing business with Tyson?
Well, they do. It's either you can do it directly to Tyson, or you can go via this route as well. I'm not. It's something to do with contracts. I'm not that well versed with all that stuff, but I just I can see like where things used to be thriving, they are not anymore, and we are pricing out our own farmers, and it's getting dangerous because in the next 20 years, the average age of the farmer is above 58 years old. So in the next 20 years, what's going to happen? Are we just going to have huge corporations own all the farms, and then we just have workers on the farms?
Well, we're heading that way. We're heading that way.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah.
And the thing that doesn't get talked about enough is one company that is kind of promoting that is one called Acre Trader, and that's what J.D. Vance has stocks in, money in. So if you want a conspiracy theory hat on right now.
the other J.D.,
yeah.
Okay.
The worst JD.
So JD, sorry, Acres. What's it called again? Acre.
Acre Trader.
Acre Trader. And what? Tell me, what does Acre Trader do relevant to this conversation?
They treat our land like just investments, for the most part. And so, like that's the thing where they don't care about what you produce or anything like that, or how healthy the soil is or anything like that. They care about the dollar. I mean, it's basically Wall Street coming in and buying up farms.
Okay. So we have essentially a monopoly within the beef packing industry. Four companies owning 80%. What should be done to address that that consolidation?
Well, I mean, that's something where we have to break up these huge, powerful in meat packing industry. So I think the first thing that needs to be done with what's happening in Lexington is the government needs to step in and say, hey, you have to sell this plant to somebody else. You can't just what they call mothball it, where it just goes away.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a demand there. And if you have a regional processor or a co-op, like at least it gives them a fair shot, mm-hmm. you know, and it gives farmers an opportunity to have options. The second thing we have to do, we have to get back to mandatory country of origin labeling in both beef and pork. We used to have it, and then in 2015, a bill, there was a timeline on it, and it went away, and nobody restored it. And as a result, we're in this situation where you get this imported beef and imported meats,
yeah.
and they can slap product of the USA as long as they've done work on it in this country. And I just think if you, like, the shirt you're wearing right now and that I'm wearing right now, it has a tag with where it was made.
Right.
And yet something as important as what we eat, we have no idea.
Yeah.
And I think that's wrong. Third thing is we need to break up these huge corporations and the monopoly in the meatpacking industry. You know, that's, we've allowed this concentration to happen far too much. And we've done this before back in the day, back in the 1920s, and we had a reaction. We had a similar thing happen back then, and they created the Packers and Stockyards Act in 1921 from a Republican congressman from Northwood, Iowa. And I think we need to restore that and modernize that and make sure that we are looking out for consumers and workers just as much as we're worried about the almighty dollar.
I would think between consumers, people who work at the plants, and especially farmers and ranchers, there would be a vast, you know, a huge coalition, a majority of Americans who would want to see a lot of these changes, and especially, you know, labeling, you know, labeling, at least knowing where the product comes from. Who's blocking that from happening? Who prevented that from happening back in 2015?
The monopoly. That's the abuse of the monopoly power. They're so... You have to understand that they're one of the largest, like, donating to politicians groups out there. And so they have, I mean, pharmaceuticals might be number one, but agriculture is number two. And it is crazy the amount of money they spend. And again, like this, when this happened, it came out just last Friday that beef packer profits hit highest level since 2022. And what happened, and that was a result of COVID. In COVID, they were suppressing farmers, or they were squeezing farmers, suppressing their workers working in hostile situations. They were making the consumer pay for all this. At the same time, they had record profits. And like they just continue on. They saw what Americans are willing to pay for it. They saw how to make more money. And that's what they're not, they don't care about the communities. And Tyson, like we had 500 white collar jobs here as a result of Tyson buying IBP here in the Siouxland area. And they took those jobs away a couple of years ago and moved them to Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the restaurant industry here in Sioux City, they feel that now, you know, things aren't thriving here as what they used to be because there's, like that's huge impacts on communities like this. And that's going to be a huge impact on Lexington and around the surrounding communities. And so, that's the America economy right now. And that's why I'm fighting all this stuff. This is why I write, you're probably getting screwed on a consistent basis to draw attention to this stuff, because this is where the battle needs to happen and people need to understand, like, this impacts all of us. It's not just a Lexington, Nebraska issue. Right. This is a grocery store, your grocery store issue.
Yeah. JD, thank you so much for this. This is really informative. Folks, if you're interested in learning more about JD's work as a legislator and as an author, check out Substack. You're probably getting screwed at Substack, I believe.
Yep.
All right, cool. Representative JD Scholten, folks. JD, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. And say hi to Brittany for me.
All right. When we come back, folks, Brittany Prater joining us. We're going to be talking about her new film regarding the Iowa caucuses. Interesting stuff. Back in a minute with you on the Fallon Forum.
Thanks to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land. Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors and our partners, including Catholic Peace Ministry. CPM promotes peaceful resolution to war and the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at catholicpeaceministry.com. westermoptometry.com. Thanks also to Western Optometry. Dr. Joel Westrom and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Western Optometry. Hey, I'd like to welcome Brittany Prater to the program. Hello, Brittany. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we've had you here before to talk about your first film, which is called Uranium Derby, and it has nothing to do with a hat. And nothing to do with a contest.
It's true. Yeah.
What is Uranium Derby about? What is this derby of which you speak?
Yeah, uranium. Well, the uranium they were casting in Ames, they developed this process, and it looked like a derby hat. So they called them derbies. So uranium derbies were these things they were making in Ames before.
In preparation of nuclear.
The Manhattan Project. Yeah, the development of the atomic bomb, which I hadn't realized was... before I started making the film, hadn't realized that Ames had played such a huge role in it. Yeah. So the film goes into the history of the making of, and it's also an environmental film, too.
Because the disposal of the spent uranium became real problematic.
Yes, yeah, and also thorium later, the laboratory. But yes, that was a problem. Yeah, that was a big part of the film.
And now you're on to something that has nothing to do with uranium.
True,
but,
yes.
But very explosive nonetheless.
this was supposed to originally be our little light, fun short film. But
yeah,
all eyes
on Iowa. This is a film about the Iowa caucuses, which, and again, the Iowa caucuses go back to not quite prehistory, but to, what, I think, 1972?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, yeah, it's a history section in our film is sort of the beginnings of the primary process itself. I think people, at least kind of in their maybe 50s and younger, don't know that there weren't really primaries as we think of them now before.
Yeah. And people would gather in people's homes, churches, and it was kind of... And an early precursor to ranked choice voting. If your first candidate didn't do well, you'd get to go to another corner of the room and stand with a different candidate.
Yeah. We interviewed the guy who was one of the two people who invented this system.
Richard Bender. Yes, so I know. Yeah.
Yeah. He had relatives in Australia, and so he knew about Australian politics and how they worked, and he thought... We should implement something.
And it
like
became
that.
A big thing. I mean,
the
it was
second round voting.
My first involvement with the Iowa caucus was in 1988, and it was already a very, very big deal. Well, it was a big deal, I suppose, after Carter used the process to basically launch his presidential campaign. But
yeah,
in 1988, it was a big deal on both sides, Republican and Democrat.
Yeah.
And again, we love the attention, I guess.
I mean,
we have. Political candidates from all over the country coming here.
Yeah.
I remember talking to some people who, you know, they told me, you see more of our governor or our senator than we do. and that was kind of cool. I understand why other parts of the country might want a piece of that.
Yeah.
But there's an infrastructure to it. There's a whole process that you need to develop to make sure you can accommodate this kind of activities, this kind of political attention, the media that comes with it, the staff that comes with it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm giving a little background for people.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much your film gets into that part of it.
Yeah, it does.
It does.
Yeah.
And then everything changed a few years ago.
Yes.
Things fell apart.
Yes. It sure did.
You talk about that in the film, I assume?
Yeah, we watch it kind of fall apart in Act 2. Yeah.
Act 1 is all the good stuff, and then Act 2 falls apart?
Act 1 is kind of the hype and the preparation, some of the history, and we're still figuring out where all of our history sections will be woven in, but I love the history sections. It's like, Vietnam War protesters, and, you know.
I mean, the caucuses were a great place to bring up issues.
Yes.
I mean, you don't just vote for, you don't just stand with the candidate you want to support. You get to vote on resolutions about all kinds of things. And
yeah.
I remember 1 year, I think it was 88 actually, we had resolutions supporting a nuclear test ban introduced in every single caucus in Des Moines.
Mm.
That was well over like almost a couple hundred, I think.
Yeah.
And we had every single caucus bring up this resolution.
Wow.
That was a lot of work.
Yeah.
But it's a really great opportunity to educate people about something you care about.
Well, I think it's great because, yeah, you have, even if you just have a few people present at a caucus who've done all their research and have their opinions, they will really, you know, caucuses are great for face-to-face interactions mm-hmm. where you can kind of, you can show up as an undecided and learn from people who are present. So that, you know, people who are, you know, in the middle of their busy work week and haven't figured out, you know, they can come and talk to different people and think, oh, yeah, that makes sense. That's a good point. And it kind of takes the power from the TV media and puts it in the hands of just everyday individuals who do research, meet candidates, all this stuff. And
maybe that's one of the reasons the Iowa caucuses no longer exist, for the Democrats at least. Again, to be clear, possibly. The Republican caucuses still exist. But
yeah.
I think the national media don't like the fact that they have to wait. Mm. You can't have an instant result. I mean, a lot of American life is all about having it now, having it immediately, having it exactly the way we want.
Yeah.
McDonald's.
It's also very hard to buy a win in the Iowa caucuses, I would say. If you have a lot of money, you still have to show up on the ground. You
really
still have
point.
To meet with people.
Yeah.
And you have to, you know, you can't just be like Bloomberg. He didn't come here and he tried to just do an ad campaign and didn't work for
right.
him, you know?
Yeah.
In 2020. I mean,
yeah, we met Bloomberg once, I think.
We did come. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
He did, but I think only once or twice.
Yeah.
And then he made a remark. He was talking about the importance of getting high-tech jobs. I mean, we need jobs like that instead of farming. He says, because, I mean, farming, what's the big deal? You put a seed in the ground, you pour some water on it, the corn comes up.
Hmm.
I mean, he actually said that
to
universal
yeah.
derision among rural. Mm. I mean, everybody from the left to the right wing talk shows were like, "What?
Who are you? And where
yeah.
do you live?"
So maybe
what
that's why he never came back. Yeah, what do you eat? Anyway.
Yeah, he. I mean, he knew he wasn't going to be able to. Anyway, but
I mean,
the film's not really about Bloomberg.
No, it's a really good point about the about money can't buy. It can't buy you love. It also can't buy you the Iowa caucuses.
Yeah.
And we've seen that over and over again. I mean, is Joe Biden perhaps an example of that? There's a candidate, probably the most established Democratic candidate around,
yeah.
and he couldn't, what did he finish, fourth or fifth in Iowa in 2020?
Yeah, I think he was fourth or I think he was fourth.
And then
but
he,
yeah,
was
he was
fifth maybe in New Hampshire?
Mm-hmm.
And what, third or fourth in Nevada?
Mm-hmm.
And yet he went on to be president?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
clearly, the money that he had to spend wasn't buying him the
yeah.
votes he wanted here in the first three states.
Well, he never quite had the charisma, and I'd say there was a former congressman we interviewed here in Iowa who said that he always tried to run the caucuses like he was running for senator of Delaware, that he was out of touch with sort of a different kind of crowd.
And who was
yeah.
that?
Dave Nagel?
Oh, okay, sure, yeah. That former party chair. The big deal was in 2020 when it seemed that Bernie Sanders and or Pete Buttigieg won the contest, won the caucuses.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's okay to tie. You know,
they didn't get the momentum from that. Neither of them did.
But I mean, isn't the problem that they were, the whole thing was botched. I mean, they were, the Democratic Party in Iowa was required by the DNC, the national party,
mm-hmm.
to use an app. I think it was called the Shadow App,
mm-hmm.
which would have immediately made me suspicious.
Yeah.
We use something called a Shadow App to count votes.
Yeah.
What could go wrong there? And then when people were trying to call, and I'm saying this, and I don't know if this is in your film or not, but
yeah.
When people were trying to call in the results of the votes in their precincts,
mm-hmm.
they weren't getting through.
Right.
There was no ability to actually report your results.
Right.
Using this app, which failed dismally.
Well, yeah, the app and the phone hotline were two separate things, but the app was, the app was funded by a company called Acronym. The woman sort of behind that named Tara McGowan, who was sort of a party insider. It was a strange story. So we interviewed a guy who actually worked on an app in 2016. There was an app that worked very well. Both the Republicans and Democrats used it.
Oh, so because it worked well in 2016, we won't use it again in 2020?
Well, Microsoft decided to pull out of all things political, so they couldn't use it again.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, so then they had to find another vendor, and then yeah. The story about that is still something we're trying to completely fill in. We have, you know, we have things that we've read. There's an investigative report into what went wrong. And I had a friend who's in tech kind of go through the report and kind of describe. They never released it to the App Store.
It wasn't tested, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. People knew it wasn't working a week or more before the caucus
already. Right. We were required, we meaning the Democratic Party, I'm speaking of as an Iowan here, not as a Democrat, I'm a registered independent, we were required to use it, even though it had already failed.
Yeah.
I mean, this is being set up to fail.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe you're digging into this way deeper than I, and I'm digging into it pretty deep, but I know there's it's a big hole. There's a lot to go into.
Yeah. I mean, there's some shared responsibility, I'd say, between the state party and the national. But I think all in all that there was sort of this idea from kind of people who lived on the coast who didn't understand what caucuses were and what the benefits were, who could see the caucuses and say, okay, this system is really messy and really, and you know, it does look that way when you kind of see the system.
By messy, we mean grassroots.
Yeah.
Down home. You know, neighborly.
Yeah.
You know, I guess that's messy.
I think they were misunderstood, the caucuses, by a lot of people in the, well, yeah, there was a commission that made new rules for the caucuses in 2017. And they, anyway, that was sort of.
So to be clear, though, the Republican caucuses in Iowa continue. We still have those.
The Democrats still have caucuses, too.
Okay, good point. But they don't. They aren't taken seriously.
They're not really first in the nation anymore. They kind of, at least for last, I mean, and the DNC has not yet announced the order, I think, of who the first five states will be in the next. But indications are that it won't be Iowa because.
But among Republican, in the Republican Party, Iowa will still be the first state.
Yes, and they will get all that media attention and all the stuff that comes here. And the Democrats will not get any of that.
But I would think the Republican Party.
Unless they come on their own, but that's then controversial, right?
I would think the Republican Party would want to help the Democrats reclaim Iowa as the first state because.
Why would they want to do that?
Well, because it's much less meaningful to have just half the field coming to Iowa. If only Republicans are coming, it's not as significant as having a process open to both, where both sides are competing very, very aggressively.
I think that possibly the Republicans might, well, I can't speak for, but I think that they might also benefit from Iowa not being first in the nation in that they are,
and,
you know,
on the Democratic side.
On the Republican side. Oh, I think the Republicans would benefit from the Democrats not coming here and not getting all that media attention. And
I disagree with that, but hey.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, I don't know.
So,
the film doesn't really get into the Republicans at all. We really focused on the evolution of this process, too. Mm-hmm. The evolution of the primary process, the Democratic primary process,
Iowa was not the only state that held caucuses. I know Minnesota, a bunch of other rural states held caucuses.
Yeah, Nebraska, Washington.
Alaska maybe too?
But they didn't have the same kind of caucus that Iowa had with the multiple rounds of voting. Their caucuses might have looked different depending on.
Well, even the Republican.
The word caucus is kind of a vague word.
Sure, it is. Yeah, well, even Republican and Democratic caucus in Iowa look different.
Yeah, they do. They look very different.
Because I've been to a
Republican
caucus.
They're very organized.
Yeah. Well, and they don't break into groups like we do. They just tell you just tell your votes on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
That's much less interesting.
Yeah, I think so, too.
We're more exciting.
I thought it was, yeah. Yeah, much more dialogue, much more kind of.
Yeah, and the issues really matter. The issues matter to the Republican caucus as well. They do have resolutions, and they vote on those as well. But I think there is an element in this country that wants to, you know, standardize everything and make it happen, you know, simply with a lot of technology and to make it happen fast.
Yeah.
Am I out of line?
I think that's very true. Yeah. And I think we should be concerned if we don't have more dialogue and more FaceTime and more, a little more mess maybe.
So in a nutshell, why do people want to watch your film when it is finally released next year?
I think it provides part of an answer of how we got here. now to this political moment with this presidency that we currently have. And it points to some of the things that the Democratic National Committee has also fixed now. They've gotten rid of superdelegates, and they have they're putting more money towards state parties again, which was woefully lacking for a long time. Mm-hmm. I think if you're curious about how our democracy works, it should be an interesting film.
Yeah. and I think implicitly what you're saying too, because the National Democratic Party kind of was very top heavy with superdelegates, among other things that they've now started to reform, you know, that top heavy approach was part of the problem in terms of why, you know, a candidate like Donald Trump could thrive in rural areas. Am I overstating that?
Well, yeah, the Republicans really didn't have many superdelegates. I mean, you could argue if they had, there never would be a Donald Trump as a president, which, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
This is sort of maybe an argument for them. I don't know. Yeah. Or maybe not. But it's sort of,
Again, the film is called All Eyes on Iowa. Brittany Prater is the producer.
Yes.
And the name of the company, your company, is Cornfield?
Cornfield Productions. Yeah, yeah, we have a website.
See, I wonder where that name came from.
Cornfieldproductions.com. If you'd like to donate to the film, we could use your help. Cornfieldproductions.com.
Yeah. All right. Well, stay tuned. We'll be talking more about this film as it finally reaches its release date next year.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Brittany, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Folks, this is Ed Fallon with the Fallon Forum. Short break and back in a minute with more conversation.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village.
All right, hey, Ed Fallon with you, folks. Welcome back. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Story County Veterinary Clinic, where Dr. Kim Holding has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Thanks also to Architecture by Synthesis. Owner Mark Clipsham asked that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. Hey, we're going to be reviewing a piece in the New York Times, and Kathy Burns is with me to help with this because she had, 16 years? 14 years.
I'm not that heroic.
Well, 14 years in the public school system is pretty heroic.
Well, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah. And, education in Iowa has been a big thing. In fact, it was our state quarter, leader in education, mm-hmm. I think was the motto on the quarter years ago. But this piece raises a lot of concerns, and I want to just kind of read through it, and then we can stop and, you know, and discuss it as we move along.
Okay.
Anyway, it's an editorial that's referencing work by a reporter named Gia Lin. The numbers are staggering. Nearly one in four 17-year-old boys in the U.S. has attention deficit hyperactive disorder, ADHD. I mean,
well,
it's disturbing, but my thought is ADHD is actually a normal condition, that we aren't meant to sit still forever, all day long, doing the same task?
Technically, there is a difference between wanting to move your body on a regular basis and the inability to be still for a certain amount of time. So I think what you're saying is that, yes, we need to be up and active, and that's the best way to learn things. But
especially for younger kids.
But we really don't have any data on whether these conditions, hyperactivity, attention deficit, in other words, just wanting to think of other things and what's being presented, whether they've always existed, and if they've affected children and families for years without kind of categorizing it as something we could help people with, or something we could, information that we could use to reform education to more accommodate children who don't sit still well, and I'm one of those.
Yeah, well, you and me both. So the editorial continues. In the early 1980s, a diagnosis of autism was delivered to one child in every 2,500. That figure now is one in every 31. Almost 32% of adolescents have at some point been given a diagnosis of anxiety. More than one in 10 have experienced a major depressive disorder. Your thoughts on that? I mean, there's a bunch of different things thrown together.
This article does focus on the school system and its impact on children's mental health overall. However, in response to those data, I would say that there's a lot more that children feel stressed and confused about than just what's happening at school and the structure of the public school system. There's economics, there's the lack of families to, whether it's a one parent, two parent, whatever kind of family it is, to be home with the children on a regular basis. We work ourselves to death in this country because of the economic system, the social expectations. And so I wouldn't just blanket that all of that data and say we need to figure out how the school system is causing this.
Yeah, and I'm not sure the author of the piece intends to do that. Mm-hmm. The piece continues, why did this happen? A lot of reasons. Kids spent hours on screens, cutting into their sleep, exercise, and socializing. Mm-hmm. Activities that can ward off anxiety and depression. Mental health screenings have improved.
Yes.
So two things there.
Yes.
Screen time, bad. Mental health screenings,
good.
Better, good, good. Yeah. The piece continues, and then there's school itself, a cause of stress for many children, and the very place it sends them toward a diagnosis. And we can read more about what they say about that, but mm-hmm. your initial take, maybe that's being too hard on schools?
I'll backtrack with a little note that being a public educator, an educator of any kind of our precious children, is a nearly impossible task to do successfully all the time. And educators face scrutinization, criticism, and they also get some kudos. But when you think about the stress on the teachers to accomplish all that they're expected to do in a day, it's not surprising that some of this also affects the children and their learning. Every child has a different learning style, and teachers are expected to teach to the style of learning. And with, 15, 20 more children in a classroom, you can kind of categorize different learning styles as someone who's more tactile, someone who's more visual, and that's a very generic way to look at it. But that stress alone and the teacher's ability to accommodate that or not can also make the school system feel stressful for the kids.
Yeah, and let me read more from the piece because I think it gets into an element that feeds right into what you're just talking about there. So in 1950, less than half of American children attended kindergarten. I was one of them. Only about 50% graduated from high school. After school hours were filled with play or work. But as the country's economy shifted from factories and farms to offices, being a student became a more serious matter. The outcome of your life could depend on it. College became a reliable path to the middle class. And schools leaned into the new standards of testing and put in place For example, No Child Left Behind. That was in 2002. Yeah, I know. And I one teacher friend of mine called it No Teacher Left Standing. But the whole idea is that, you know, we have to have, this is kind of related to my previous conversation with Brittany, this need for national standards, for standardizing everything, for finding a way to measure it, to make it easy and convenient for people who want to analyze data. And is that kind of what's happened with No Child Left Behind?
Very much so. I think No Child Left Behind was the culmination of the previous years-long pressure on schools to respond to the business world, the academic world, the world that wants kids to be ready for jobs. The corporate world, either when they graduate high school or when they, quote, go to college. And for a long time, trade schools were left out of secondary education or higher education learning. All of that pressure then was part of, you know, the No Child Left Behind then was established as part of the public demand for schools to get kids ready to work and ready to produce and ready to be part of our community. But the developing the child as a whole was left behind. Mm. That's what was left behind. Yeah. All the children were left behind.
And to remind people, I mean, Nickleby, No Child Left Behind, was co-sponsored by two politicians that I happen to like.
I'm sure.
Ted Kennedy on the Democratic side, mm-hmm. and John McCain on the Republican side.
They had good intentions, but I'm sure they were responding to a demand that presented what seemed to be rational ideas without looking at the needs of the business community and the corporate world instead of the needs of the children to develop into the people they will become.
That to me is the underlying problem with facing public education right now, is the demands that the corporate community have placed.
Thank you for acknowledging that, because a lot of people say the problem with public education. And public education is so near and dear to my heart. I mean, all children deserve the same chances and chances that fit their needs, not just, nothing against, you know, private education, that's great. But to put so much blame on public education for the woes of the world right now and the woes of America right now is extremely brutal.
So back to the New York Times piece. States rewarded schools for having high scores. They punished schools for low ones. Schools were treated more like publicly traded companies with test scores as proxies for profits. Before long, schools had public ratings so ubiquitous they now appear on real estate listings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that says it all right there.
It does. And the way the scores were tallied and presented was not by these tests. What was important to the outcomes was not the raw scores of the student. In other words, if you took a test and you got 75% of the things on it right, you were not granted, and the schools were not granted, how well are the kids doing overall, but how do they compare with all the other schools in percentiles?
Yeah.
So if your school ranks in the 50th percentile, it's doing better than 50% of the other schools, and then all the schools get better equally the next year. That school will not look like it raised its quality of education or outcomes at all. If the kids start performing at 90% of the questions answered right, and all the other schools did the same thing, that first school will still be in the 50th percentile, looking like they're not growing and learning.
Let me continue with the editorial. And there were clear incentives to diagnose students with psychiatric disorders. Treatment of one student, especially a disruptive one, could lead to higher test scores across the classroom. And in some states, the test scores of students with a diagnosis weren't counted toward a school's overall marks, nudging results higher as well. Was that your experience?
There were students who, if they could be qualified as having a condition that kept them from achievement at that time in their lives in the school system, yes, they were allowed to be excluded from the overall school reporting so that they wouldn't pull the average down for everybody
else. So which again, as the piece says, encourage encourage the use of diagnoses.
That maybe. Mm. I mean, incentives, maybe motivation. I'm not sure. That seems a little harsh. But I never saw a lot of students willy-nilly being labeled or diagnosed as something but I did see students whose scores were pulled out.
Right. Well, to continue the effect, the piece writes about the effect on kids. The pressures on students became extreme. In 2020, Yale researchers found that nearly 80% of high schoolers said they were stressed. And that stress has trickled down to younger and younger kids. Kindergartners learn best through play, not through the rote lessons in math and reading that began to enter classrooms. Preschoolers are not predisposed to sitting still. And yet, correct, as they too now face greater academic expectations, many are being expelled for misbehavior. Even the school day became more regimented with fewer periods of recess. By 2016, only 8 states had mandatory recess in elementary schools. Class schedules are packed. You've got 7 different homework assignments that you've got to remember each night, one expert told the reporter. Think of the cognitive load of a 6th grade boy. I challenge many adults to do this.
All of that it speaks to truth. I do want to just think about some historical perspective on the demands of younger children. I'm thinking about my grandfather, who, you know, I'm writing a book about his life, and when he was taken in by a family at the age of 3, by the age of 6 or so, he was expected to toe the line for chores, for manners, for his religious education, and raised with a lot of stress and pressure, as a lot of other children were. So
A different kind of stress.
But I don't know if kids have more stress today, but that would be an interesting thing to really look into longitudinally.
Well, and there's a big time period between when your grandfather was dealing with that.
In the late 1800s.
And, yeah, yes. and now the 2010s. And, I would say that, I didn't really like school as a kid.
I know. You talk about it a lot.
But you like school.
Yes, I did. Even though I don't sit still well, I was very good behavior oriented.
Yeah.
I wanted to please.
I didn't like school because I didn't like getting beaten by nuns.
No.
And also I found the curriculum in high school extremely boring and irrelevant. But I wouldn't say that it stressed me like I see, the analysis of today.
I had kind nuns by junior high and high school when I was in public education. I enjoyed learning because I had an exceptional environment for learning, Harlan Community High School, Harlan Community Schools in general, and I had a group of friends who challenged each other to do well, and we were excited about learning together. Mm. And I don't know if that's, and it wasn't necessarily a small school. We had 200 or so in my graduating class, but it was an active learning environment with a lot of great extracurriculars. So I had a very different experience.
I'm jealous, but it seems to me like even that is slipping away. Nowadays.
Maybe. Yeah. I think it's a different pressure on kids to do something different than just learn and enjoy.
Well, interesting stuff. We could talk a lot more about this, but that's a good start. Kathy, thank you so much for helping to research this conversation. And stick around, Kathy. We'll be back in a minute, folks. More Kids Talk. We're going to be talking about the Healthy Kids Iowa program, whether it's working or not. Back in a minute on the Fallon Forum.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone.
Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design build services for high performance, low maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon and Kathy Burns with you here. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help through the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay negotiated fee basis. Contact DavidDrakeFamilyPsychiatry.com. All right, so Kathy, you were at the Iowa Farmers Union Annual Convention, and one conversation that you thought would be worth discussing was the discussion about the report on the Healthy Kids Iowa program.
Yes, and this is Birds and Bees' first year to be a member of the Iowa Farmers Union, their annual convention. I wish I could have stayed for the whole thing.
The weather
got in the way. Go figure. So the annual convention began with the Iowa Local Food Summit that was hosted by the Iowa Food System Coalition, also in coordination with the Iowa Farmers Union. They had a state agency panel, so four state agency heads with roles relevant to local food and agriculture, and then they had a state legislator panel, and we'll talk about that next week. But there were some interesting discussion specifically around the Healthy Kids Iowa program,
which we've discussed on this program before.
Yes.
Critically, I mean, we haven't been very impressed. What was the overall take at the convention?
Well, and I'm gonna give a shout out to Iowa Capital Dispatch reporter Cami Coons, because I wasn't taking thorough notes, but she has a couple of articles about the convention, and I was able to reference a lot of her stuff. So instead of allowing the SNAP benefit recipients $40 a month per eligible child during the summer months on their EBT card, their electronic benefits transfer card, Governor Reynolds decided to not do that, not take any of that benefit, and just prepare these boxes at distribution centers.
Yeah.
And it was,
which people have to travel a good ways to get to.
Yeah, it was it was intense. So Aaron Drinnen, the director of community access and eligibility at the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services, was part of the panel, and she explained that this year, 66,000 children were served with the food box program, the Healthy Kids Iowa program. However, in previous years, especially the most recent year for the actual debit program on the SNAP card, I think it was 220,000 children served. So
a lot
of children are getting left out. She also noted that there were significant challenges at distribution sites. They had trouble communicating changes to the program. For instance, quote, non-citizens were disallowed from the program, and also just coordinating all the time and energy to get the food procured, to get the boxes boxed up, stored safely, refrigerated, whatever the need was, and to get all the volunteers in place at every distribution center in the counties to distribute this. That was a big stress for
her. And I believe the motivation of the governor is that she doesn't like it when people take the EBT card and buy junk food. And I get that. But That seems more like an excuse than a reason to ditch the whole program.
Next week, we're going to talk about the state legislator panel, and we'll hear some of them, their comments. But that was discussed quite significantly. People are quite split on whether children should be fed the food the state decides they should be fed or what their parents choose for them.
Yeah, well, you know, and this legislature and this governor always talk about, well, parental choice, let parents decide.
Absolutely.
But here now the state is deciding.
Where'd that go?
Where'd that go? So, I mean, what's the real motivation? The real motivation seems to be just kind of a disdain for the poor.
Well, I know that Governor Reynolds had to get special permission from the government to not include Iowa on that program for 2 years in a row. The final report on the project, on it's a pilot. It's not out yet.
We'll see what
happens. We'll be watching for that.
Kathy, thanks for joining me. Folks, thanks to my guests this week, J.D. Scholten and Brittany Prater. Also to our production squad, which includes me and Kathy, and Sherry Herdina, Forrest Detterman, and Charles Goldman. Thanks also to our local small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Westrum Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and real estate agent Joe Henry. Thanks also to our nonprofit partners, Catholic Peace Ministry, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. And finally, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. This is Ed Fallon. We'll be back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.